Liquid Books, Budapest's weekly English language cultural magazine.
Welcome to a very special episode of Liquid Books. We are broadcasting this week from Bijan Carpet Gallery in Budapest, so we're on location. And we're pleased to welcome as our guest this week, Dian Alai. Dian, hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here in your program.
Our topic today generally will focus on issues of human rights in the world, and I'm wondering, first, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your background and your work in these topics.
Yes, well, I'm French and Iranian, and I live in Geneva. I have been working in the field of human rights for the past, I would say, 16 years. And I am now representing the Baha'i International Community, which is a non-governmental organization with consultative status with the United Nations. And I'm doing so at the UN in Geneva. My main focus of work is, as you mentioned, human rights.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the UN does in this regard?
Well, the UN is very concerned about human rights. And there was actually a commission on human rights that used to meet regularly for 6 weeks per year in Geneva, just to deal with human rights issues. This commission, as you might have heard, has recently been replaced by a Human Rights Council, which is actually going to be hopefully more powerful than the commission. So in fact, it's an upgrading of the interest of the UN to human rights. That council will be able to meet throughout the year. So, you know, in a much more consistent manner than just a 6 week yearly.
One advance of the Council, based on what I've heard, is that they can also expel members on the Council for human rights abuses.
Absolutely. With two-third votes from the membership, if a member of the Council is felt that it's committing gross human rights violations, then it can be expelled from the Council. So hopefully the UN will be able to deal even more strongly with human rights situation with this council.
What are the levels and stages which the United Nations can use to deal with particular human rights abuses?
You see, what I think is the most effective and the most important probably in the work of the United Nations is to actually put a spotlight on governments that violate human rights of their own citizens. I think that this is the most important, what I have seen as the most important, because even the worst governments that you can think of do not like to be finger-pointed at as violators, and they will always defend themselves, saying, no, we respect human rights, we are not human rights violators. So I think that, in fact, this is how, in my opinion, the UN is extremely effective, by putting out in the open for everybody to know what the human rights violations of some countries are. And also, of course, politically, from in a sort of, you know, multilateral, bilateral way, from governments to put pressure on other governments about their human rights record.
Is the UN limited in this regard by being a political institution? And how does its work compare or relate with that of an organization like Amnesty International, for example?
Oh, absolutely. The UN is often criticized, but at the end of the day, the UN is just governments that, you know, get together. So it's not an entity in of itself. And it's those governments that decide. And clearly, governments have political agendas. And so, therefore, it is clear that there are some countries that, even though they have an abysmal human rights record are going to be, not mentioned or not considered for some political reasons because they have friends or because they're powerful themselves. On the other hand, non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International, as you mentioned, but many others, are independent. And therefore, if they can have a non-biased approach and just report on human rights violations as they occur.
Can you give a brief overview of the situation of human rights in the world today? What are some situations which are evolving and what are the key issues involved?
I think it's quite difficult to give an overview, unfortunately, because there are so many human rights violations that are committed in the world. But I think that one of the issues of concern actually of a number of NGOs, including the Baha'i International Community, about the work of the Council is that it would also take into consideration rampant human rights violations. Because, the very grave human rights violations that have outbursts, they make the headlines. And therefore, there is the attention of the public opinion and therefore of the international community to those situations. But the ones that have been ongoing for many, many years without any sensational development at one point or another tend to be forgotten. And because they're not cases of emergency per se in a given time, but they are very grave, throughout the year. And these sometimes don't really make it on the agenda of the UN.
Mm-hmm. What types of abuses fall under the purview of human rights abuses?
Oh, all sorts of abuses. It can be, of course, the UN divides them into two groups because of the two covenants. They're the civil and political ones, which you can imagine is, freedom from detention, freedom from torture, the rights of individuals to be able to have freedom of religion or belief, etc., etc. And then there are the economic, social, and cultural ones, which are, the right to health, the right to education, the right to adequate housing, the right to be able to speak your ethnic language, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm. Presumably, the conditions of refugees in different countries is a big part of the focus of the Human Rights Committee.
Well, this is one of, certainly refugees and displaced persons is one of the very grave problems that we have to face today. And in fact, I think that this is one of the subjects that I would call a rampant human rights violations that maybe doesn't make the headlines, where, hundreds, if not thousands of people are displaced and have been living in camps with, very poor, poor conditions and still with, violations of a lot of their human rights. Maybe they're not tortured or imprisoned, but, they don't certainly don't have a normal life. And they're not necessarily, or they don't often make the headlines.
Mm-hmm. You are involved with the Baha'i International Community. Can you tell us about any human rights cases which involve Baha'is in the world?
Yes. That, in fact, this is one of the issues that is of concern to the United Nations. And this is the situation of the Baha'is in Iran. Although I would also call that situation one of the ongoing systematic and gross violations of human rights, although I think that recently there has been one case that has been very worrisome. But I think that the situation of the Baha'is in Iran is that the Iranians, they are considered not recognized by the Iranians. And therefore, they suffer between civil and political, economic, social, and cultural. In fact, for the Baha'is in Iran, the violations of their rights is on all level. It goes from arbitrary arrest, torture. There was torture not so recently, but particularly in the first years of the Islamic Republic, executions, then, you know, denial to access to education for young Baha'is. For 20 years, young Baha'is have not been able to go to university only because of their religion. Denial of access to works, particularly in the public sector. Refusal of receiving pensions for people who are retired. Confiscation of property. Non-equality in front of the tribunals. And then, of course, also as Baha'is, impossible for them to practice their faith like any other religion. Baha'is cannot meet, they cannot elect their institutions, which in the Baha'i faith, because there is no clergy, serve as clergy, elected institutions at the local and national level. Their cemeteries have been desecrated. They cannot bury their dead in a proper manner. And the Baha'i holy places have also been confiscated, and some of them totally destroyed.
You say this is in Iran an example of a sustained, ongoing human rights crisis or set of violations. What are the historical roots of this?
The historical roots are mainly religious. The Baha'i faith was born in Iran in the middle of the 19th century. And in fact, the founder of the Baha'i faith, Baha'u'llah, has announced that he is the new manifestation of God for this time. So, of course, this has raised a lot of difficulties for the Baha'is, particularly coming from the Muslim clergy in Iran.
What is their situation relative to other religious and minority groups?
Yes, you see, as I mentioned, the Iranian constitution, although it says that the religion of Iran, the official religion, is Shia Islam, and a particular group of the Shia Islam, it says that it recognizes three religious minorities. And these three religious minorities are the Christians, the Jews, and the Zoroastrians. But the number of these three groups put together sort equals the number of Baha'is in Iran. So we estimate that there are between 300 and 350,000 Baha'is in Iran, and that's also the estimation of the Christians, the Jews, and the Zoroastrians together in the country. The three recognized religious minorities don't have the same rights as the Muslims in Iran, but yet they still have some rights, whereas the Baha'is are denied all rights.
It's because the others are recognized officially by Islam in the Quran?
Well, you see, for the Christians and the Jews, this is the case. They are what is called in Islam the people of the book. The Zoroastrians are actually not, but because they are the original religion of Iran, they have also been accepted by the constitution of the Islamic Republic, where you will find that they're not necessarily recognized in other Muslim countries.
From what I understand you're saying, the Baha'i faith then is the largest religious minority in Iran?
Absolutely, absolutely. As I said, the estimation that we have is between 300 and 350,000. And these are official records. They're not the Baha'i records. They're UN and other official records.
How has this story progressed recently?
Yes, I was alluding to this case recently, about a month ago. The Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief, the UN has special rapporteurs, which are independent scholars or individuals who are given a mandate to study and report on a particular situation. It can be on a particular country or it can be on a subject. So on the subject of religious freedom, there is a special rapporteur, which at the moment is a lady called Asma Jahangir from Pakistan. She's a human rights defender and a lawyer. And recently, she actually, in a press release, announced that she had in her possession, she had received a copy of an extremely confidential letter that was addressed by the head of the command of the armed forces in Iran. And that letter was addressed to all the police forces, the Revolutionary Guards, the Secret Services, the Ministry of Information, in order to identify all the Baha'is throughout the country and monitor their activities. And the special rapporteur herself said, expressed, and this letter, sorry, I must say, was also endorsed by the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. And so the special rapporteur, Mrs. Jahangir herself, expressed her grave concern at the fact that people from a given religion would be identified and listed and their activities be monitored. And I think that this recent development is very, very worrying for the Baha'i international community, particularly because we ourselves can put it together with other information that we have received, which is that approximately at the same time as that letter was issued, the media, a newspaper that is directly under the guidance of the Supreme Leader, but also television and radio, official Iranian television and radio, have started a defamation campaign against the members of the Baha'i Faith and the principles of the Baha'i Faith. That newspaper that I mentioned actually issued a series of 30 articles nearly daily against the Baha'i Faith. And the concern that we have is that this campaign is really incitement to hatred, and particularly because the Baha'is have no right to be able to print a response in those papers or in the media in general, because they have no rights in Iran. They don't have the possibility of giving their answer to the false accusations that are made against them. So if you look at this campaign of hatred combined with identification of all the people who belong to the Baha'i Faith, it really is a very dangerous situation for the Baha'is in Iran at the moment.
And this is a novel situation. It's an extraordinary step, so it's not consistent with what came before.
Absolutely. We have not seen such a thing. I must say that, you know, at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, people were really killed, tortured, and executed because they were members of the Baha'i Faith. So the situation was extremely grave. But still, there has never been such a campaign of trying to identify everyone and at the same time creating a sense of hatred throughout the country. And this has started in November of 2005. So it's really, really recent.
At present, are Baha'is free to worship as Baha'is openly and to assemble and to pray together and so on?
No, absolutely not. Baha'is don't have the right to practice their faith in Iran as any other believer, particularly those, the Muslims and the recognized religious minorities have.
Let's take a short break and then we'll continue. We're back talking with Diane Alai, Baha'i International Community representative to the United Nations, about the plight of the Baha'is presently in Iran. Diane, let me ask you to put this in a philosophical context, if I can. What is the overarching notion of religious freedom which applies generally in the world and in this situation in particular?
Well, I think there are two issues. The first one, and I think this has been raised by the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion and Belief. Actually, at the time, it was a law professor from Tunisia called Mr. Abdel Fattah Amour, but clearly it's something that the new Special Rapporteur also endorses. And this is that it is not for a government to decide what is a religion and what is not, and which religion it should recognize and which one it should not. Everybody should be able to practice whichever religion or belief they choose, or even choose not to have one at all, as long as they remain within the framework of law and public order. So I think this is the first very important principle that is clearly not necessarily applied throughout the world. We know that there are some countries like Iran or others that recognize some religious some religions and don't recognize others, and so give rights to some and less to others. There are other countries around the world that register religions, and this has also been a problem that has been raised by the Special Rapporteur of the definitions and criteria for religions to be able to be registered by that government.
Is what you're saying dependent on the separation of church and state? Because it seems like there are a lot of governments in the world that are religious governments. Is that in conflict with what you're saying?
No, actually, this is interesting, is that you have some some governments that actually say that the religion of the country is a particular one, and yet they don't necessarily want to recognize all the others and let people practice their religion. And you have other governments which are secular, and yet for certain forms recognize only some religions in order to put, for example, in the ID cards, or, as I said, want to register the various religions and put certain criterias allowing or not allowing religions to be registered in that country.
Isn't that, from one point of view, a sensible thing to do? If a country wants to provide a society which is open for any religious belief, isn't it sensible to make a definition of what is a religious belief so that the state can fund such activity, can support such groups, and therefore have a clear definition of what's encompassed by religious freedom? How can you have a law without concretizing it?
Well, you see, this is the thing, is that there is a difference between being able to receive certain subsidies by the government and being able to practice your religion freely. And so between intrusion in people's private lives, which is, you know, their belief, and between the fact that, okay, if you have a certain number of believers, then you're entitled to have by the town, you know, a free room to be able to assemble, but you know, you can get that room if you're over 100 people. I mean, these are the things that seem very logical, but unfortunately they're not necessarily, you know, the combination of the two. This is where the problem is that if applying for some help because you're a larger group, like any other, I don't know, group of people which are not necessarily, which do not necessarily share the same religion, is one thing. And then trying to register and give a definition of those that can be accepted and those that cannot, which is certainly a violation of freedom of religion or belief.
What about where a religious practice interferes with the law of the state?
Yes, this is something else. I mean, there have been cases in front of the Human Rights Committee of things that are unacceptable, And therefore, if a religious practice is absolutely unacceptable in front of the law, then it cannot be accepted. There was a just to give you an example that I can remember in front of the Human Rights Committee, there was a group that said that in fact what they worshipped was hashish. And so therefore, giving that the object of their worship was hashish, they were allowed to have and to grow it because this was the main object of their worship. And so there the Human Rights Committee that said that this, if this is illegally unacceptable, it cannot be used as an excuse.
I've heard of a similar case in the United States of Native American Indian churches who utilized peyote and other natural Indo-producing hallucinogens in their worship services, and actually the Supreme Court, surprisingly, of the U.S. Accepted that, and those Indians are permitted to use those illegal hallucinogens in their religious ceremonies.
You see, I think this is it, is that it depends whether this, what the historical backgrounds are. If I suppose for indigenous peoples, the situation is that they have the right to do so because it is based, is a fundamental base for their belief. But if a sect is created, it's recently created, I know 10 years ago, to give themselves an excuse basically to use drugs, then it's a different situation. And I think that legally the courts can very, very well decide what is acceptable and what is not.
This illustrates even further that it is a complex issue, and that it's neither satisfactory to make no judgments whatsoever nor to make judgments. So it seems ambiguous no matter how one views that kind of a question, particularly when one takes into account the fact that many governments are so-called religious governments. Now, what about the case of a Muslim government where, according to Muslim law, let's say, as far as I understand it, technically, it may be apostasy to leave the Muslim faith that you are born into. What is the notion of religious freedom in that case? Because here, two religious laws are in direct conflict with each other, the laws of one religion and the understandings of another, or of defenders of freedoms and religious freedoms generally.
Absolutely. But you see here, in this particular case, in the case of apostasy, in fact, the Special Rapporteur on Religious Freedom has herself very clearly said that the right to choose or change one's religion is accepted. And this you can find also in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights under Article 18. So it's something that is actually widely accepted, because you know that the Universal Declaration is a text that is accepted by all the members of all the countries and governments that are members of the United Nations.
In other words, Muslim governments have voluntarily agreed to abide by this Universal Declaration.
You see, this is a very interesting question, because there is the Universal Declaration, and there is, of course, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is the instrument that needs to be signed and ratified by governments. The Declaration is a de facto, everybody accepts the Declaration, but they don't necessarily need to sign and ratify it. It's something that is accepted as one of the guiding principles of the UN. And the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, although it defines a freedom of religion or belief, and although the definition that has been expanded by special rapporteurs or other specialists on this issue say that it also includes the right to change one's religion, doesn't actually specify it.
If a Muslim government, a so-called government of a Muslim state, condemns a man to death for changing his religion, or a woman to death for changing their religion, technically that is legal under international law.
I wasn't clear. It is illegal. What I meant is that when you're saying that they have voluntarily accepted it, it is not the case. But in fact, this is the guiding principle, and the definition of freedom of religion or belief is that there should not be, there is the right to change, to adopt the religion of your choice, and to change one religion. But so if a Muslim government actually, if somebody in an Islamic country is condemned to death for apostasy, that government is violating the right to freedom of religion or belief and can be criticized for it.
Mm-hmm. Again, just to try to understand it fully, they can be criticized and the UN can disagree, quote-unquote, with that behavior, but that country has not signed any binding legal agreement that they are not permitted to make such rulings.
Well, you see, this is the case for a lot of all the human rights, because even if they have signed those binding texts, there is no coercion in the domain of human rights and within the United Nations that can force a country to do so or not do so. So the fact of signing and ratifying a document is, if you wish, a commitment. But in any case, none of those documents can force a government to apply those human rights principles. And that's why we see so many human rights violations throughout the world, is because, in fact, the UN can only adopt resolutions or other texts that will criticize or call upon a government for their human rights violations. But that's where it stops.
How then does this story evolve? How is it evolving? What are the increasing channels of cooperation and agreement on these issues that we see evolving?
Unfortunately, I think that at the moment, this is where we stop. We within the framework of the United Nations, and I think that in fact, this is one of the difficulties that the United Nations face, is that because it is composed of governments, there are principles that everybody agrees on, and that there are standards that people are or governments are expected to uphold. But that's where it stops. And I think that that's where we should and we need to come back to the individual and be able to change that, because governments have their own limits. And as long as they remain sovereign governments, we cannot go any further except with the use of force. But that's only under the Security Council, which is a totally different situation. As you very well know.
So right now the sovereignty of governments to enforce any laws within their borders is total and absolute, except in the case where collective security is at risk.
Absolutely.
Then please explain, what is this wonderful sounding notion of going directly to the individual?
Well, I think that every individual has a responsibility himself or herself. I think for the well-being of his country, but I think now we go beyond those borders, those national borders, to the well-being of humanity. And so therefore, in the same way that every citizen clearly knows this, you know, I think citizens' rights and responsibilities are very well understood today. Well, people know that they're going to make a change by what they do, by their vote, and by other actions that they can take within their own country. I would suggest that this possibility goes far further than and beyond the limits and the borders of their own country to, you know, the planet.
The notion of globalization lies behind many such conversations of different aspects of national questions and supranational questions these days. What you seem to be suggesting is that the time is ripe to go beyond national borders in terms of the, what, not the enforcement exactly, but the education, the mutual cooperation of peoples, the mutual support, the sharing of information. What concretely are ways in which we are growing beyond national borders in terms of human rights issues these days?
Well, I think it's been going on for a while, because I think that the simple fact that people are now joining non-governmental organizations, such as the one you mentioned, for example, Amnesty International, but not only on the international level, even on their own national level, shows that people really want to get together in order to do something for other people around the world who suffer human rights violations. And so I think that these are some of the things that we have already seen. If I can bring it down to another level, I think that it is, as I mentioned, if the UN is composed of governments, then it's also a possibility for the individual to put pressure on his own politicians, whether it's the members of parliaments or whether it's the government itself, to do something and to put pressure on another government that they feel concerned about. So, you know, write to their MPs or others and raise their concerns about violations that are happening in another part of the world and asking their government to do something about it. But beyond that, I think that there is something that is equally as important, if not more important, and perhaps is we go back to the conversation that we had at the very beginning about, you know, those human rights violations that make the headlines and the ones that are rampant. And I would say that this is just the opposite. One is the way that you can address issues in an immediate fashion, and prevent further issues from happening in something that is more long-term. And that is trying to apply all the human rights principles, become familiar with them, know what the Universal Declaration says, and then try to apply those in one's life. Try to develop or get rid of racist attitudes, or try to promote the equality of men and women within one's own family or within one's own workplace, which are things that seem quite, in theory, you know, we would all very much want to for racism to disappear from the planet or for the rights of men and women. But when it comes down to our day-to-day life, it becomes a little bit more difficult to put it into practice. So I think that if each individual would try to make that effort, then possibly things could change fairly soon. Maybe it will take a bit longer, but it will change.
Let's take a short break and then we'll continue. We'll be right back.
iluminar toda la tierra.
Que puede
iluminar toda la tierra.
Que puede
iluminar toda la tierra.
Que puede.
Tan potente es la luz.
We're speaking with Dion Alai, United Nations representative from the Baha'i Faith, about human rights in the world. Dion, it seems like one key question that motivates how people respond to human rights violations is their perception of self and other, the perception of how close to them a conflict is. Does that ring true in your experience?
Yes, I think that clearly we can see that the easiest it is to relate and to identify oneself to the other person who is the object of that human rights violation. It is the more people are concerned and the more they express their concern. I will say that it's not necessarily true, and thanks God for that. I think that there are people, and there have been really mobilizations for human rights violations. But in general, I think it is much easier. It's a very natural way of looking at things. If we can relate to something, then of course, if we can feel the pain ourselves, it is certainly something that will create a reaction in a person.
From that, then, it seems like one long-term strategy forward is to create some sense of shared world environment, to create some sense of commonality and to foster common bonds among all peoples in order to reduce the possibility of self and other, of putting people in categories of nearness or farness in terms of rights.
Oh, absolutely. I think that if the concept of belonging to one common human family is developed, there will certainly be a very different attitude towards human rights violation and a much greater mobilization of people for other people across the world. I think that already you mentioned globalization earlier, and I think that globalization of the media is certainly something that brings awareness, because we are aware, we hear of human rights violations that happen in other parts of the world when we might not have done so some year back because there was no access to it. But I think that this is one thing, but the second one should be that development of that consciousness within oneself as well.
Uh-huh. There was just a survey done recently, I think by the BBC, if I'm not mistaken. And I say it with the caveat that it was a big media organization that conducted the survey, but the conclusion was that people in the world nowadays generally trust their media more than they do their governments. So that's a sign that there is a sense of responsibility in the global media generally. I'm talking about, I think the survey was focused on global media, so the big network media.
Which, in fact, I think also increases their own responsibilities to cover all stories and not necessarily only the most sensational ones, which is, I think, one of the problems that we see today.
Yes. So then we have looked at this from the point of view of the highest level, the evolution of the world toward, ideally, a more collective consciousness. We've also mentioned, equally briefly, unfortunately, but we've also mentioned a notion of personal transformation in making one's own values in one's life in harmony, so applying the universal principles in one's immediate surroundings, in one's family, in one's workplace, in one's community, and so on. What about the intermediate level? How can the individual start to act collectively? What organizations are out there for people who want to either learn more about these things or to participate more in defending against human rights violations?
Well, I think that, you know, the number of non-governmental organizations has exploded in the recent years. And I think that this is a very positive sign because it shows that people are taking, you know, things in their own hands and decide that if their governments or if governments in general do not want to make those commitments, they want to do it. So I think that the options are really, there are plenty of options. One is to, of course, join one of the big international organizations that we talked about. But one is also to look around and see if there are smaller national or regional organizations that address the issues that, you know, people are concerned about. And I think the last one, which is totally possible, really today it's possible for anyone to start his or her own organization and start working with other people who are like-minded and who want to also do something for one issue that is of particular concern to that group.
If people are concerned about, for example, the fate of Baha'is, where can they turn to for more information?
If they want to have information about the situation of the Baha'is, then they should, I would recommend that they go to the website of the Baha'i Faith, which is www.bahai.org. But if they want to do something about it, then I would say, for me, it's probably twofold. First, they can, as I said, write to their parliamentarian or any other person to see what their own government is doing about the situation of human rights in Iran and particularly of the situation of the Baha'is, or try to join, because all the major human rights organizations, be it Amnesty International, be it Human Rights Watch, be it the International Federation for Human Rights, they're all very supportive of the plights of the Baha'is, and they all themselves issue statements. So, of course, they can also contact them and see whether they can do something through these organizations.
And in terms of self-education, if I understand rightly, your educational background is in international human rights. Is that right?
Absolutely. I've studied international relations and human rights.
How did your education prepare you for the reality of the world? And what pointers can you give to our listeners who want to read more about these issues?
Well, you know, I studied in France, and France has a very particular characteristic, is that unlike other countries, for example, the United States that you mentioned earlier, it's very theoretical. So when I started working, I realized that everything I had learned was very much theoretical and very little practice. So for me, that was actually a shock. And so I knew everything in theory very well, but not so much in how it functioned and all the nitty-gritty, particularly, of the United Nations and of what governments do within those frameworks. But I think if people are interested and want to educate themselves, I would again recommend for them to go to the websites, particularly of the large human rights organizations like Amnesty International or like Human Rights Watch or like FIDH, the International Federation for Human Rights, because they provide information in general about human rights, but also in specific issues, themes, you know, which talked about racism, we talked about equality of, you know, violence against women, equality of rights of men and women, or other issues, religious freedom, or about particular countries if they're interested in one country or one region.
And do you have any other advice for people who either want to get involved with these topics or want to know more about these topics generally?
No, I think that perhaps if this conversation that we've had has encouraged people who are listening to your program to really think about human rights, to really think about the fact that It is the responsibility each one of us. And I truly believe that if we decide to already change something in our own behavior and in our relationship with the people around us in applying human rights principles, then I think that we will very soon see a major change and a major change in the human rights situation around the world.
Do you see any signs that that conversation is moving in a hopeful direction?
I am hopeful.
Uh-huh. And has your experience shown that prevention and attention on this level really can diffuse or even prevent a crisis on a large scale?
I think I'm very hopeful because I have seen that, first of all, as I said earlier on, governments are... it is important for them to keep a good reputation. So in fact, you can exert pressure. The international community can exert pressure on governments. It would not necessarily totally solve the problem, but it will certainly prevent things from getting worse. And I'm also very encouraged because I've seen a lot of men and women very courageous who have decided to really take risks to defend the rights of others. And this is certainly something that gives a lot of hope for the future.
Dian Alai, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today about human rights.
Thank you very much for inviting me and having me here.
From our engineer Naji and from myself, good night.
La maldad y mires la maldad, no te rebajes, no suspires ni te lamentes. No digas nada malo para que eso mismo no llegue a tus oídos. No agrandes las faltas de los demás para que tus propias faltas no sean agrandadas. Es la humillación de nadie para que no sea expuesta tu propia humillación. Vive entonces los días de tu vida que no son más que un momento efímero. Con mente inmaculada, corazón sin mancha, pensamientos puros, carácter santificado, para que libre y contento te desprendas de este cuerpo mortal y te encamines hacia el paraíso místico y habites para siempre en el reino inmortal. No escuches la maldad, ni mires la maldad, no escuches la maldad, ni mires la maldad,
no escuches la maldad, ni mires la maldad, no escuches la maldad, ni mires la maldad, no escuches la maldad, ni mires la maldad,
no escuches la maldad.
Escuche la maldad.
evil and see no evil. Abase not thyself, neither sigh nor weep. Speak no evil, that thou mayest not hear it spoken unto thee. And magnify not the faults of others, that thine own faults may not appear great. And wish not the abasement of anyone, that thine own abasement may not be exposed. Live then the days of thy life, that are less than a fleeting moment, with thy mind stainless, thy heart unsullied, thy thoughts pure, and thy nature sanctified, so that free and content thou mayest put away this mortal frame, and repair unto the mystic paradise, and abide in the eternal kingdom forevermore.
Got that,